George Enenga versus Byron Starnes. Mr. Nathanson?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I would, at the outset at the very least, like to focus my attention in the argument to the prematurity of damages issue regarding the claim of plaintiff India Enenga. Seeing as how the summary judgment that the district court entered was without prejudice and there are issues about when and if such a claim could be refiled under the district court's reasoning. The plaintiff's second amended complaint in this case, pursuant to which this case went forward, pleads in paragraphs 18 and 19 that plaintiff India Enenga, as a result of a negligently drafted estate plan, was required to share her father's trust with the other six grandchildren involved here, that she only got a 1/7 interest in her father's trust upon his death, whereas which was a per capita distribution, whereas the grandchildren of her aunts, the other six grandchildren, did not have to share their parents' trust per capita, but rather was per stirpes.
What remedy are you seeking?
Your Honor, the plaintiff is seeking, plaintiff India Enenga, who was a 14-year-old minor, is seeking damages against the attorneys.
Well, so is her father as well, right?
On a separate theory.
Right, so this is a damages action.
It is indeed against lawyers, not the probate estate.
Right, so the remedy is operating against the lawyers and not the estate.
Right.
And how would you propose to measure damages?
We would propose to measure damages initially, as pleaded in the second amended complaint, as the difference between what India Enenga would have received under her father's trust had she received the entire corpus of her father's trust as per stirpes, the other grandchildren are in line to receive the entire corpus of their parents' trust.
How can that be measured?
It can be measured, Your Honor, because as the district court and defendants concede in this case, her father's trust is a spendthrift trust. It is not a discretionary distribution trust like the other trusts. And the spendthrift trust cannot be invaded except for its 5% a year and extreme health emergency.
How can any of those contingencies be quantified, and how can we know what her interest will be worth years and years from now upon the happening of all the various contingencies in order for her to recover? All of that is unknowable.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think future damages, it's pretty well established by all the damages cases cited by the parties, have to be reasonably certain to occur. They don't have to be
certain. Well, right. We can be reasonably certain that her father will die at some point, but we can't know when that is. We can't know how much will remain in the trust at that time. We can't know what it will be worth. That's why I'm asking this question. By what method do you propose to quantify the value of that trust at the time of his death when we don't know when that will be and what will happen between now and then?
As Your Honor pointed out, this is a negligence action against lawyers. It is commonplace in malpractice cases to offer life expectancy tables to project future lost income, future medical expense.
That's a very different proposition. That's when you're quantifying compensatory damages like lost wages and pain and suffering over a natural life expectancy, et cetera. That's not what this is.
Well, we know what the amount is in the trust today.
Okay.
It's in the plaintiff's answers to interrogatory, $750,000. I believe it's paragraph 9D in the answers to interrogatories.
We have no idea how much will be left at the time of India's father's death. And I don't I haven't yet heard a proposal from you about how that's to be evaluated.
Well, Your Honor, the proposal from the plaintiff is that as I stand before this court today, she can never get more than 1/7 of that trust. 6/7 of the trust are gone to her because so whatever ultimate amount that turns out to be on a quantitative basis. The cases say that if the nature of the amount of damages is unascertained, that the fact of damage is sufficient to make the case not premature. As a matter of fact, she cannot get 6/7 of her father's trust. Whether it's, and I have several damage calculations, but it's somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000. The difference between what she's going to get as 1/7, which is somewhere between $107,000 and $185,000.
How did you arrive at those numbers?
Okay, well, 1/7 of $750,000 is $107,000.
Right, but there's not going to be $700,000 in the trust.
Right, but you if
it's going to be depleted over time, so we can't use that figure. Right?
It can only be depleted 5% of the value. It's a spendthrift trust.
Right, so it's going to be reduced in value by 5% every year.
Right.
Did you factor that in? Your damages calculation.
I'm starting out with the gross numbers. Okay, assuming she got 1/7 today, it would be $107,000.
Right, but we can't make that assumption because her father is still alive today.
But the ratio is the same. I mean,
I understand the 1/7 part of this. I'm tracking with you on that.
Okay.
I just don't know how you're proposing to get at your damages figure. Well, what will you argue to the jury? Let's say we send this back. What will you argue to the jury?
I'll argue to the jury what's typically argued in malpractice cases, that the life expectancy table shows that George Enninga has a life expectancy of 74 years, that he's X years today, that therefore there's 13 or 15 years left, 10 years left, whatever it may be, that there's an attrition rate of 5% a year, that the balance of the trust is X dollars, that it's reasonably likely to be X minus based upon the remaining years of his life, because it can only be invaded for emergency health purposes. Surely the plaintiff doesn't have to negate or rule out every contingency in the world in order for damages to be reasonably certain to occur. And the difference would be the 1/7 that she's going to get as opposed to the 7/7 she should have received if her father's trust was per capita. Was per stirpes like his sister's trust were. And under the Northern Illinois Physicians case in Illinois and the other cases cited by both sides, the plaintiff has to establish the fact of damage, not the amount of damage. I don't even think the defense is disputing that in this case.
Well, you do ultimately have to establish the amount of damage. It's just that you can't get kicked out of court if you don't.
Well, I agree with
that. Right.
Which is, Your Honor's right on the point. We have been kicked out of court. India has been told, come back in God knows how many years. I'm not sure whether she has to refile when the first aunt dies, when both of them die. I guess that could be the year 2050. And I guess this law firm may or may not be there. Their carrier may or may not be there. I think it's putting a plaintiff in a position in a malpractice case where future damages are always reasonably estimated.
Now you're switching theories here on damages. You're not just claiming that she her damages flow from the fact that she has to share her own inheritance from her father with her cousins, but that she doesn't get a piece of her cousin's inheritance or inheritances from their mothers. That raises a whole different set of questions.
No, it does, but I apologize if it appeared I was switching theories.
You're claiming both, apparently?
Well,
no.
We pleaded that she has to share her father's trust with the other grandchildren, and they don't have to do the same. The district court ruled in the district court's summary judgment opinion that the claim is premature until her aunts and her father die.
Right.
So I was reacting, Your Honor, to the when you refile under the district court's prematurity rule.
Right, I understand that. So I'm trying to zero in on what damages you're claiming she has suffered. Is it solely the damages that flow from the fact that under this estate plan she has to share her inheritance from her father, from her father's trust, with her cousins? Is that the sum total of the damages that you're claiming, or are you also claiming that she doesn't get a piece of her cousins' inheritances from their mother?
Our expert witness, Professor Lindgren, said that he discerned, at least there was a question of fact as far as he was concerned, that the testators, the grandparents, wanted the grandchildren to share 1/7 apiece of the total estate, which is, everyone agrees, $3 to $4 million. It's $4 million under the evidence we offered. The defense says it's 3 to 4. I'm not sure there's anything to argue about today on that front. So what we're saying is, as a general proposition, she should receive 1/7 of the whole estate. In order to effectuate that, the expert said, and we quote his opinion in that regard in our reply brief, at the bottom of page 7, that it was a deviation from the standard of care to have the grandchildren both per stirpes and per capita on the one side, and my client only per capita. So the way to effectuate that, what we're asking this court to rule, is that she should, since those grandchildren, the other six, take per stirpes of their parents, she should take per stirpes of her father, which means she should get the 7/7 of his trust. So I apologize if it appeared I was shifting out of that. There's certainly been discussion in this case about everybody sharing equally, but when it gets down to brass tacks, how do you effectuate that in reality in this case?
Right, because you can't get a remedy against the estate at this point, because that is long gone.
It certainly is as to India. There are issues here as to George Enega, which are raised.
The time has expired for...
Time has expired for estate claims. He certainly made a claim regarding improper administration of the trust regarding the purchase of the family home. And the district court disposed of that on a 12B6 motion long before the summary judgment on statute of limitations and res judicata grounds.
But not only that, the time has expired in state court. This will was admitted to probate and has been deemed valid, as I understand it, right?
It was not challenged.
It was not challenged, right. There's been no will contest, so that's over.
Absolutely
the will has
true.
Been probated. It's been deemed valid because there was no challenge. George and India could have brought a will contest, right? But didn't. And so that option is gone. So why isn't this a collateral challenge, an impermissible collateral attack on an estate plan or a will that's been probated and found to be valid?
That issue was raised in the Ogle case in the Supreme Court of Illinois. And the Supreme Court of Illinois said it's not an improper collateral attack or collateral challenge because nothing that could happen in this legal malpractice case vis-a-vis these lawyers on a damage theory can alter the estate plan at all.
That was a decision from the Illinois Appellate Court, and a few months later the Illinois Supreme Court issued a decision called Robinson versus First State of Monticello or Bank of Monticello. Are you familiar with that decision, the Robinson case? How do we reconcile those two opinions?
Well, I think it's plain that I'm not asking this court to upset the estate plan or to alter the distribution of the money. Whatever those trusts provide, they provide.
Right. The plaintiffs in Robinson weren't asking for that either. They were seeking a tort remedy. And this is a tort remedy, and it operates as a collateral attack against a will that's been probated and found to be valid because there was no will contest.
Well, the issue here are revocable trusts. This has nothing to do with a will contest. In fact, we're not asking to effectuate the will at all. The issue here is the Thomas Anninger Revocable Trust that was created during his life, that was distributed upon his death to his three children, his two daughters, and his son George Anninger, and so you're telling me
that the arguments that you're making in this action about the intent of the parents and grandparents here could not have been made in the context of a will contest in probate court? It's my understanding they could have been made, but weren't.
My understanding is you can't challenge a revocable trust in a will contest. Now, I will stipulate to the court that I don't draft wills or trusts, so you may find someone to disagree with me on that point. But the issue here is what was to occur with this trust scheme that was amended by these Minnesota lawyers. The will is not really implicated here. And in terms of a will...
The will simply provides that all of the estate assets flow into these three trusts, right? Or into the family trust, which is then dispersed in thirds.
My memory is there is a pour-over clause, Your Honor. However, the trust antedated the will, and the provisions of the trust were funded to provide for the Anningers themselves, Thomas Anninger and Ida Anninger, before the will was probated. And then when he died, he had left instructions in the trust instrument to then set up the sub-trusts for the daughters. So I don't really think this case implicates a will contest. Now, whether it could have been challenged is a whole different issue. The basis for a challenge is a whole different issue than whether the lawyers have a duty as a matter of a duty of care under Pelham and all the cases after that to draft something in accordance with what their clients wanted drafted. And with respect, I'd ask to reserve a little rebuttal time. Thank you.
Is it Mohiban?
Mohiban.
Good morning. May it please the court. The court focused on the prematurity decision as to India's claim, and I think your questions really do bear out the fact of the uncertainty of whether there will be any damage. It's not a question of whether the amount of damage is uncertain. There simply is, as the district court found, no way to know now whether India will ever suffer any damages if you assume that she has a valid claim. And there are a number of contingencies that need to be determined. One of them is even whether India herself will survive her father, because the way Section 8 of the will is set up, she only recovers if she is alive or if she has living issue at the time of her father's death. Also, as the court pointed out, with respect to any remainder interest, that's uncertain because George is allowed to draw down the 5%. And the terms of the trust provide for a number of things, not just emergency health care, but provide that he can get additional distributions for emergency health care, for what's termed to be emergency support, and also for any other type of purpose that the trustee determines in his sole discretion is appropriate if there are not other resources available for George. So given all these contingencies, there's simply no way to know today whether there will be any remainder. And because of that, there's no way to see if there is any fact of damage. And that was a proper basis for the court to dismiss. Now, we were happy with that decision, but also we had argued further on two different grounds that the dismissal should be with prejudice and not without prejudice, as the district court did. I think the district court's decision was fine as far as it went, but it simply didn't consider these two other arguments that were argued. Now, the court mentioned the Robinson case, and we have briefed in our brief on appeal here the distinction between the Ogle case and the Robinson case. Now, this is a matter of a collateral attack on an estate plan. There was a provision, there were legal remedies available to George and India at the time that this will was in probate. They chose, for whatever reason, not to attack it at that time, not to challenge the validity, even though they had access to all the information that they have access to now. So then the question is, can you bypass the probate procedure and then come forward later in a tort action and then argue on the basis of what's referred to as extrinsic evidence, that is, setting aside a signed estate plan, which is prima facie evidence of the testator's intent, set that signed document aside, and then make an extrinsic attack. The Robinson case said you cannot do that if you were able to have brought those claims in probate. That's exactly the case we have here. This is on all fours with Robinson. The Ogle case was different because in that case, the claim was that these people had been entirely divested of any interest in the will. Consequently, they were not an interested person who had the ability to bring a claim under the Probate Act. Because they had no remedy in probate court, they were allowed to make this challenge with extrinsic evidence. That's not the case here. There's also another reason why this court should consider our cross appeal and dismiss India's claim with prejudice, and that's, quite frankly, the fact that there is no factual basis for this claim. And the court considered this on summary judgment. The plaintiffs had every opportunity. They took depositions. They took all they needed the discovery. And at the end, they could not put forth any kind of viable factual support for the claim that the estate plan as drafted did not effectuate the intent of the entitlees. Now, the evidence that's in the record is unequivocal in support of the lawyers meeting their client's instruction. Their duty here was to listen to what the entitlees had to say and make sure that the estate plan met that intent. So what is the evidence that we have? We have the signed estate plan, which is intended to demonstrate the entitlees' acceptance of the estate plan. We have the testimony of the attorneys who were involved, which is undisputed, as the only remaining witnesses of these attorney-client communications, in which the attorneys testified that they met the intent. And then you can go beyond that, and you can look at a very detailed, professional, documented record between attorney and client demonstrating that the entitlees understood and specifically approved the idea that India would only get a per capita share of any residue of her father's trust. This is documented in three critical documents, setting aside the signed estate plan.
There's a video in 2002, though, that expresses the view that they wanted all seven grandchildren to be treated equally, isn't it?
There is a video which, if anything, is simply confusing. And my argument there is whatever happened in 2000 has no bearing at all on what the instructions were by the entitlees to their lawyers in 2 years earlier when they were preparing this estate plan.
I don't quarrel with that. The testator's intent is an issue here, and we will we'll look at that. But there is a factual matter aside from the intent of the testators. It is true that India, to use a slang expression, is getting the short end of the stick here, isn't it?
Well, it's true that India is getting what her grandparents intended for her to get.
That's not the question I asked. Factually, she is being treated adversely compared to her six cousins.
I would respectfully disagree because you need to consider that there is only one gift to grandchildren in this estate plan, and that is the remainder of George's trust. And that is shared equally by all grandchildren. There were no other gifts to the grandchildren. The gifts that were made under the estate plan to George's two sisters were outright gifts. They have no no spendthrift trusts. There's no provisions that the sisters have to give anything at all to their grandchildren. So as a literal matter, Judge,
I'm not talking about a literal matter. I'm talking about a factual matter. As a factual matter, if I was India, I would look at this and say, something's haywire here because my cousins are treated so much more favorably than I am.
Well, obviously that's her claim, but I would suggest that just consider this case between the Enningas and their son George. The assumption that is being made here is that the sisters are going to give all that they inherited from their parents to the grandchildren. But here we have an example with George where that isn't the case, where he was given something different from the other grandchildren. So implicit in India's argument is somehow that the grandchildren for sure are going to get what their parents got by virtue of the parents' decision when they do their own estate plans. And that, I would suggest, is uncertain as well. Going back to the question of the video, though, I don't think it has any bearing on what the lawyers were told at the time that they did the estate plan. And the critical documents there are the May 18th letter that Mr. Burt writes, in which he says India is going to get 1/7 of her father's residue, if any. And there's a letter 2 days later from Tom Eninga on May 20th, in which he says, I've read Mr. Burt's letter, and I agree with it. So if you're looking for an instruction from the clients as to what's to be done here, there it is. And then you have on July 13th, Mr. Stortz's detailed letter. You know, if you ever wanted to look for an example of a lawyer documenting properly in the file what the client's instructions were, here's a detailed 6-page letter in which Mr. Stortz lays out exactly what the estate plan is going to be, exactly as how it ultimately was drafted. And this was provided to the Enigas. And Mr. Stortz wrote another document as a memo to the file, again documenting the same idea, which is that India is going to get a 1/7 share of any remainder. So what you have is 5 separate documents that document this was the intent. So what's the evidence to the contrary? If this case goes to trial someday, there's no witness who's going to come forward and say the Enigas meant something different than what they told the lawyers as set forth in the estate plan. Nobody's going to testify to that. The only evidence that's ever been presented here is notes and isolated comments from the preliminary discussions between the Enigas and their lawyers when they were just starting out the process of determining what the estate plan would be. And even there, in the very first notes, you see 2 different threads of thought, one of being a goal that the grandchildren should be treated equally, another one being a goal that India has very wealthy parents on the other side of the family.
Is that true as a factual matter?
What?
That the parents on her mother's side are well off, and she's expecting or will eventually get a big estate from them.
What I know is that's what the Enigas told Mr. Stortz as reflected in his notes. I don't have any other knowledge beyond what's in the record. But what I will say is what was conveyed to the lawyers in the very first meeting was that India might be treated differently because she had wealthy parents on the other side. And in those very same notes, and this is what's remarkable, because the appellants want to focus on this one note in one meeting 5 months before the estate plan was finalized. But on that same page, there's a reference to George's remainder being shared equally per capita by all the grandchildren. So what you have is an initial conversation in April in which the lawyers and the Enigas discuss a number of different ideas, and then a process over a period of several months in which conclusions are reached and documented in paper, in letters back and forth, and ultimately in the signed estate plan. So on that record, can any reasonable jury really find that India did not get what her grandparents intended for her? I would submit that on this record, there simply isn't evidence to show that there was an instruction provided by the Enigas that was not followed by the lawyers as set forth in the estate plan. For that reason, we ask the court to grant our cross appeal, dismiss this matter with prejudice. There are other issues relating to George and his share and a trustee issue. Those are all very well addressed by the district court in its detailed opinion. And unless there's any questions on that, I will rest my argument.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 3 minutes.
Co-defendant, the Illinois lawyer involved in this, Mr. Burt, was received a letter from the Minneapolis Lawyers Counsel's firm, Leonard Street and Dinard. And the Minneapolis lawyers said on the second page of this May 5th letter, which is document 132-2, because they now have seven grandchildren, they would like each grandchild to ultimately receive or benefit from 1/7 of the estate, either as a direct gift if their parents have died or as an indirect result of inheritance by their parents. Now, counsel said there's no witness who is going to testify to that. This is documented in the notes of the Mr. Storitz, who prepared the estate plan. This is documented in correspondence in this case. I deposed Mr. Storitz and asked him about the intent issue, and he said the intent of the testators was in flux on the 1/7 issue as far as he was concerned, which gets into the opinions of our expert witness, who said if you believe as an estate planner that the intent is in flux, then you have a duty to make certain disclosures to the testators. Namely, one of which it was and should have been, according to the reporter Professor Lindgren, that you are drafting an estate plan to benefit your law partner's children over your law partner's niece. Counsel's partner, Byron Starnes, is married to one of the Enninga daughters. He has three children. His children take more than my client, India Enninga, because his partner from counsel's firm drafted an estate plan to favor Mr. Starnes' children over my 14-year-old client.
I thought that theory of malpractice was no longer in the case because the ethics code of both states permits this. It wasn't that the basis of the original motion to dismiss in this case, and so that conflict of interest theory of the claim simply dropped out of the case.
Your Honor, the district court ruled as to the initial pleading that a conflict of interest under the Code of Professional Responsibility is not independently actionable by itself, and directed me to amend on a negligence theory, which I did. But my expert witness, at the end of his report, says, if you believe the intent as a matter of negligence, as a matter of duty of care, if you believe the intent of someone is in flux on a point, then you have a duty to the client to explain to them that you are drafting something for your law partner and his family, which he said happens every day in law firms, that probate lawyers in big firms are asked to draft estate plans for their partners. He said, but in this case, you're being asked to draft an estate plan for a partner that prefers his children over other children of the testator who are similarly situated. And as a negligence matter, he had to advise the client of that and obtain appropriate waivers. So it's not an independent claim of conflict of interest. It's in the mix of what disclosures have to be made. If you believe the testator's intent was in flux, we offered evidence that said, Mr. Storitz wrote in his notes, goal equals, and my time is up, 1/7 equal treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.